Exoskin.com. It's Christmas time.
Hey, and there are presents under the tree, and if we're lucky, inside those presents are some Exoskin.
Exoskin has a lot of really deep discounts. You can find those by going to the show notes. But let me mention a few. 25% off if you go use a certain code. If you buy a shirt.
Are we keeping this code secret, Scott?
Yeah, it's in the show notes. Okay. We want more people to go to the show notes.
All right.
If you buy a shirt or if you buy a bottom, you can get a free pair of socks or leg sleeves. And then there's volume discounts on socks. You can get your friends together and pool your resources and get yourself some Exoskin. Go to our partners page and click on the Exoskin banner. Go to the show notes to get the codes.
Exo holiday, 25% off, Scott, because nobody goes to your show notes.
Yeah, they do.
Pathprojects.com.
They're great gear if you haven't tried it. We want to introduce you to Dean. Dean is a Path Projects user. Dean, tell us a little bit about how you got started with Path and what you like about it.
I actually heard about Path Projects through 10 Junk Miles, your competitor.
Not a competitor. trail friend.
Yeah.
Awesome. Honestly, I'd been running in some old shorts, like four or five pairs that I'd had for a couple of years that I just kept going over. And I was starting to have trouble with between the legs, a little bit of chafage on long runs. And so I was looking for something different. So I bought some baseliners and a couple of sets of Sykes and pretty much instantly was impressed with how quickly I could go out on a run, come back and basically be 100% unaware of any issue. So I love them. They've worked great from day one. In fact, about a week ago, I got up one morning and just grabbed a quick pair of shorts and threw them on. They weren't my Path Projects. Jumped on the treadmill and about 20 minutes into a run, first day back on the treadmill, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I got to stop and go change my shorts.
You don't want chafing to take you out of your training run or your race. Make sure you get some Path Projects. Those baseliners are awesome. Try them. If you haven't, you should. It's gift giving season. Give your friends a Path Projects gift card.
Right on, Dean.
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards. And
I've never prepped for a podcast, ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
What, are you balancing your checkbook over there, AJW? What's going on?
Yeah.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Welcome to, thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation.
That's not what you say.
I did that for you, Scott.
Thank you. You made me feel good today. Hey, we have Alex Hutchinson with us again today. His book, which is Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curious Elastic Limits of Human Performance, is one of those reference books that you have to have on your shelf. It's a multiple time read or listen to. If you can remember, and I'll link these in the show notes, we did three podcasts where we went through every single chapter of the book.
We took AJW, Magna Belay, and you and I. We each were assigned a chapter. We read it. We discussed it. And then we thought, would it be amazing if the author, Alex Hutchinson, would even take our call?
And he did.
And he answered, and we had a chance to talk to him.
And more impressive is he took it again. He's here again. I don't understand how that works, Alex.
He has some issue with memory, apparently.
Hey, Alex, thanks for coming on again. We really enjoyed the conversation we had with you prior. If you don't know who Alex Hutchinson is, besides that incredible book, he's an award-winning journalist. He writes for Outside Magazine, New York Times, The New Yorker. They're probably every magazine out there, you have an article, right?
And recently, he's been on a morning television show. Tell us a little bit about that, Alex, and welcome to the podcast again.
Thanks, guys. It's great to be back. And I appreciate the very nice intro. The only thing I'll just disagree with is I don't recommend reading the book more than once. It kind of the pages get kind of worn down. So if you want to read it twice, you should buy another copy. That's my only suggestion.
Good point.
It self-destructs.
Exactly,
the pages are made out of biodegradable material. And once you turn it with your fingers, it dissolves.
Kind of like that old television show. What was that? Do you remember that? Where that tape?
Mission Impossible. This message will self-destruct. This book will self-destruct if you try and read it twice, but I do recommend picking up an extra copy just in case.
I will tell you the value is there. Every time you do read it, you're going to get at least the dollar amount back every time you read it.
And so. It is the gift-giving season. You know, you have friends. That's a perfect gift under the tree. And so
not just for runners, by the way.
Endurance athletes.
Yeah. Well, okay. not just endurance. It could be for anybody that's trying to become more resilient.
Humans. I think that pretty much covers the group. Tell us about being on a television program.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys. And yes, I'm glad to have the opportunity to say that I made my debut on Good Morning America yesterday. And I found out about it a mere few hours after I made my debut. They didn't actually talk to me, but they lifted a few quotes from a podcast I'd done with Vox. They do a podcast called Reset. I had a 30-minute discussion on, or maybe it was even longer, a 40-minute discussion on the complexities and nuances of Nike's new Vaporfly shoe, which is very controversial these days. And they lifted, 10 seconds out of that to make it look like I was a raging critic of the shoe and put a picture of my face on the screen. So I started getting messages on Twitter saying, you simpleton, you idiot, how could you think such a, have such a narrow opinion of this shoe? So I was excited to be on GMA. Maybe next time I'll actually get to speak to them.
I would bet that is probably a huge issue with as many articles and podcasts that you've done, where people take comments out of context and then just blast out their own agenda, and then you're there to gather up the pieces.
Yeah, I it's something I worry about. Fortunately, I take pretty good care to never give a straight answer to anything that anyone asks. So my defense is to ramble as much as possible, and then it's hard to find a straight soundbite. But the thing is, I was having a beer with a friend last night. He's like, well, did they totally misrepresent your views? And I was like, well, the truth is, this is such a complicated issue and I have such sort of conflicted views about it. You could state pretty much any opinion and attribute it to me, and I'd say, yeah, that's fair. I mean, I do agree with that. I also have other opinions, but it's not like they're putting words into my mouth. It's just that I have a lot more words that I would have liked to tack on.
Hey, and that's one of the things that I really enjoyed about the book Endure is you didn't tell us what to think. You gave us all the options. Here's what some people are saying. Here's what others are saying. And here's what we've seen in the field. Now you figure it out. At the end of the chapter, you're not telling us how we should think.
Well, to some people that's a feature, to others that's a bug. I mean, that's the way I like to think, and I think there's a lot of people out there who like to be, and nobody's, I'm not claiming I'm Mr. Super Impartial. Of course I have opinions, but I'm just trying to lay out the information. But I definitely get people who are like, so what was the conclusion? Like, what do you actually think? And I'm like, I don't know, it's complicated. So yeah, it depends on your approach, I guess, and your willingness to tolerate ambiguity.
Well, I think that's a safe place to be is, even now, I mean, you look at Tim Noakes, who is one of the greatest minds in endurance sports, and he had strong opinions and they've changed. And he's one of the biggest men to say, I was wrong on that. But things are changing. And so as we learn more and more, it's good to have an open mind and not maybe it's good to have an opinion. I'm not saying you shouldn't have an opinion, but it's good to be flexible and open-minded to listen to someone else's opinion. Boy, that sounds like we should start a political show, Don. we should all sit around the fire and sing Kumbaya. Hey,
well, it is really tough to change your mind. And I definitely give lip service to that. I really, really, really hope that if the evidence changes, I change my opinion. But man, that's hard to do. And I can see it in myself in the way I read new studies, that I'm always eager to read the studies that reinforce some position that I've taken before. And with studies that contradict something I've written, it's pretty tempting to just be like, oh, I'm too busy to write about that this week. I'm not even going to look at it. Or I'll look at it and say, oh, I can't believe, I had a small sample size or this. You look for the holes instead of trying to be convinced. And I'm aware of this and I try and fight it, but man, it's it's very hard to change your views, which is why I try to not get too firm into any of my views.
And that's what I really enjoy about what you put out there is you stand on a lot of research, because I'm a research guy. Not that I'm doing the research. I don't even own a lab coat. But I'll tell you that I like that you bring all the studies together and then synthesize them and then come out with something. So let me ask you this question. What have you swapped your mind on? What research has swayed your strong opinions, or maybe not you, but us as a general running population? What have we learned?
Yeah, there's a few areas where things have kind of moved around. One of the classics is, and this is of course a perennial topic of discussion, is hydration. You know, I grew up and was an athlete with the conventional view of hydration, which was that more is always better and you could never get enough. And you know, you should basically have hoses running into your ears and your eyeballs to get as much fluid in as possible. And then, you know, and this is really the topic that got me interested in sports science, to say this isn't just like, this is an active area where people disagree. Back in about 2006, I read a debate between Tim Noakes and someone else, another scientist, on... And the title of this was in a scientific journal, and the title of the debate was, "Does dehydration impair performance?" I was like, man, what is this, like sweat, physiology for kindergartners? Like, of course dehydration impairs. This is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And then I read Noakes's case, and it was like, it opened my eyes. I think you guys are all familiar with the counter argument that actually, you know, you should just drink to thirst, and we have a perfectly good way of homeostatically regulating. So I kind of flipped over to the other extreme for a little while, thinking that, you know, all hydration science is corrupt and, you know, corrupted by Gatorade, and we really should just drink to thirst. And then, you know, in the last, let's say, 5 years, I've kind of, you know, moved back to my natural hunting grounds in the kind of middle of the road, where I'm like, oh, you know what? Drinking to thirst is a great idea in theory, but I'm not sure it actually optimizes performance in all contexts. Yes, I mean, evolution has equipped us with this wonderful thirst system, but evolution wasn't trying to run the fastest possible marathon on a hot day. Like, you know, evolution tells you to slow down when you're getting too dehydrated. Mm-hmm. And if you don't want to slow down, maybe you need to think ahead. And also, if you want to drink to thirst, you need to have fluid with you. And if you're running a marathon, say, or a trail race, you don't necessarily have fluid with you at every moment. Now, some people carry it with them, but lots of people are running races where they're just drinking at fluid stops, and you might be thirsty halfway between two aid stations. Or if you're running really hard, your awareness of thirst might be impacted by your awareness of how miserable and painful everything else in your life is at that moment. So anyway, all of which is to say, That's a prime example of an area where I started in one place, went to another place, and I'm realizing that I may have overcorrected. And and I think my experience probably mirrors the way the field has gone too a little bit. Like, there are lots of people at every extreme still, but there was a broad shift from like hydration is everything to hydration is nothing to hydration is something, but it maybe not as much as some people think, but more than others think.
I think ultimately that statement will stand the test of time, drink to thirst. But I think where the breakdown is we need to define thirst. You know, we all have a different definition for that word. And the clues that are coming in early, like, no, that was thirst. You missed it. You know, 30 minutes ago, you had the clue that thirst was there and you missed it. And that's why you're sitting on a rock.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think also, like, so when I talked to Louise Burke, who's a great, a nutrition scientist at the Australian Institute of Sport, she has this much more, you know, complicated matrix of, it's a spectrum, right? Like, sometimes you're just drinking to thirst, sometimes maybe she thinks you should be drinking to plan. And what goes into that? Well, it's the environmental conditions, the race, the distance, but also personality factors. Some people are super in tune with their their sensations and their feelings. Others are not. Some people are really good at following instructions. Others are not. And so the same set of instructions will mean different things to different people. Drink to thirst to one person is like, if your tongue starts literally falling out of your mouth, maybe you should think about drinking. Whereas to other people, it's like, you know, if you just feel not 100% wonderful, that must mean you're dehydrated. And both of those extremes might not be optimal. So yeah, maybe you're right. Drinking to thirst is right. It's just a question of optimizing our understanding of thirst and being able to communicate that effectively to a broad population.
So I think that, and you correct me because I'm just throwing out a question, and you're the expert. But a lot of these studies that you look at are looking at athletes that are doing maybe 5K, 10K, half marathon stuff, and I'm sure there's some different demands or requirements for each distance. Not to get hung up on extra long stuff, but I've got to think hydration strategies are much different in a 5K that many research studies are done, and perhaps 100K, which there's not a lot of research on. Somewhere in there, Alex, there's a question. If you could rescue me, reframe the question, and provide the answer, it would be awesome.
Perfect. Yeah. No, there's no doubt. And I mean, I think research has very little at this point to offer for someone running, let's say, a 12-hour race even.
Yeah.
It's just how many studies have looked at that? And that's not just about hydration. That's about fueling. That's about cramp prevention. That's about, you know, pacing, all these things. It's like we can extrapolate a little bit, but, you know, it's a different world. And even if you tried to run like a randomized study of like 12-hour races, you can't just have someone come to the lab every Saturday and do a 12-hour race, you know, 6 weekends in a row. So, and you know, you're going to get a total of like 3 volunteers for this study too. Mm-hmm. So, at that, you know, once we start pushing, especially beyond the marathon distance, I think we're really into the realm of, you know, practical experience is key, and science can inform some of the answers to those questions and give some hints. But anyone who says we know what we need to do, you know, in an ultra marathon race, I think is overstating the realms of science. And I think the evidence that I've seen, or the sort of general sense I get, let me say the general sense I get is that the longer the race gets, the more we need to fall back on perceptual cues like drinking to thirst. In a shorter race, like in a marathon, I would be tempted to argue that there's a case for, because of fueling and hydration, there's a case for just sort of making a plan and saying, I'm going to drink this much and I'm going to drink it even if I don't feel like it, because I think my pre-race plan is probably smarter than my body or my brain's ability to understand this, the very bizarre situation I'm putting it in. It's sending me signals that aren't right. So I'm drinking this much every 5K and that's it. And I don't think that approach works in an ultra. I think in an ultra, the longer it gets, the more you have to be able to respond to, like, I'm feeling this, I'm feeling that. I can speed up. I can't speed up. I need solid fuel. No, I just need some liquid or whatever. Because I think the more sustained it is, the more we have to be able to feel what the body's asking for.
And we have the luxury on the trail to go ahead. If we drink extra, no problem. There's a place for a bio break.
There's an exit.
They're anywhere along the way. But the road, I'm going to have to do some pacing coming up here on a road for an assignment that I'm doing. And one of my fears is, you know, Mrs. McGillicuddy probably doesn't want me to sit stand in her bush for a while and then move on. I'm afraid of this. You know, I don't have that trail luxury.
Yeah, and there are some fairly famous instances of marathoners being caught on camera, and you know, I ran one marathon for a story like what, 6 years ago, and you know, so I collected a lot of data on it, and so I sometimes show the graph in talks of my pacing, and I was like, I have just rock solid, perfect, even pacing until 30K when I start falling off the face of the earth, but except for like 18K, there's this spike in there. It's like, yeah, I had to pee. Like, I was focused on getting fueled and hydrated, and at, you know, more before even halfway into the race, I had to pee. And if, you know, if you're really trying to maximize your performance, you're not going to run your best marathon if you have to stop. And it was like, it was, as you said, I was running along this like residential neighborhood, bit of freeway. All right, I'm going just right by the side of the road. And then, you know, so using that opportunity when there weren't too many houses or people around.
Go ahead, Scott.
I wanted to change the subject.
You're on this podcast. Yeah,
please.
I'm sorry.
No. I you know, probably one of the biggest topics that has hit endurance running in decades has been this whole breaking of the 2-hour marathon by Kipchoge. And I want to get from you, because I have people coming up to me that know that I run. And they're not runners. They don't follow sport. They know about it, and they have their opinions about it. I want to know What's your view on this whole thing?
Despite what they said on Good Morning America.
Yeah. Well, if you have 4 hours, I'll give you the full take on it. I watched it. I got up at 2 a.m. to watch the streaming, and it was exciting and it was cool. I think Eliud Kipchoge is a remarkable human being. I think it's pretty cool that someone managed to cover 26.2 miles in less than two hours. It's not what I would have, if Eliud had called me up earlier this year and said, listen, Alex, I know you're a smart guy. I want you to tell me what I should do this fall. I ran 2 hours and 25 seconds at the Nike Breaking 2 event back in 2017. I've got the standing world record set at Berlin of 2:01:39. What should I do next? I would not have said, you know, call the circus again and have this exhibition event. I would have said, if stage an event, maybe, but do it in a way that's eligible for world records. So you can do a lot of the things that don't happen at Berlin and Chicago and London and so on. You can have a whole bunch of pacemakers. You can have a special course that's just a loop or whatever, so that there's no hills. You can do A, B, C, and D or whatever, but don't do the things that make it not record eligible, because it's just at a certain point, and it, you know, once you decide you're not going to obey the rules, then it's just arbitrary. You're like, well, why not do it the whole thing downhill? Why not do it on roller skates? I'm not making a full equivalence. There's a big difference between doing it with pacers who jumped in halfway and doing it on roller skates. And Kipchoge's achievement was amazing, and I do think it will, you know, in the same way or in a similar way as the Breaking 2 thing, will sort of change our concept of what's possible. And so, you know, Kipchoge's tagline is "No humans are limited," and it's like, well, you know, some humans are more limited than others, dude. But as far as I can tell, I think it's great. I think it's great what he's done, but it's not what I would have done, and I would like to see going back to just sticking with the agreed upon rules. And I haven't even mentioned shoes yet, which is of course another ingredient to this. The truth is, you know, I've been a little conflicted about Nike's Vaporfly shoes, which have a curved carbon fiber plate and a thick layer of this sort of space age new foam midsole material. They're just too good, to put it simply and frankly. And what I didn't like about Vienna is there was yet another prototype which had an even thicker midsole and even more wacky features, some sort of pods that no one's quite clear what they do, and they didn't disclose what's actually in the shoe. There's rumors that there's even multiple carbon fiber plates. It's like, you know what, I could get used to a new, like, everyone getting 2% faster, say, because now everyone's wearing shoes with carbon fiber plates. But do we have to have a new shoe every year? Like, does it have to keep ratcheting up? So that kind of tipped me further towards the idea that this should be regulated. That let's just say, you know what, shoes can have a midsole that's 31 millimeters high, and that's it. And then you can do whatever you want in those, but let's not end up with moon boots. So anyway, that's a scattered, rambling take on what I was thinking the morning after sub two.
I like it. I mean, I think I have similar views that, yeah, it wasn't official and everything was optimized. But when it comes down to it, the guy ran freaking fast, and he's a freaking fast, amazing athlete. And I hope that maybe by him breaking that barrier, just like Bannister broke the 4-minute mile, that now it opens it up to possibility, and I hope that it's going to break. Somebody's going to break it at a real sanctioned event soon. So
one of the sort of, so Bannister is obviously a very common comparison to this, and people use Bannister as a bludgeon in both directions. Like, it was amazing, Bannister, broke this barrier, or Bannister was a pure of heart, and he would never have done this sort of monkey business with all this, pacing and stuff. And so what I like to remind people is, in 1953, 1 year before Bannister broke the 4-minute mile, he ran a race where he had pacers, which were controversial at the time. But one of his pacers just jogged for the first half of the race until Bannister lapped him. And then this pacer paced Bannister for the whole last lap, so that all the way to the finish of the race. So not only did Bannister have pacers, which were controversial, he had illegal pacers. And he ran 4:02, which was a British and Empire record. But that record was disallowed. They refused to ratify it because they said, this is a farce. This wasn't a real race. You had illegal pacing in it. That was 1953. And Bannister was like, okay, I agree. That's fair enough. We won't do that again. But he also said, once I ran that race, I knew I could run 4 minutes. And so the race under artificial conditions was one of the key stepping stones that got him to the race under real conditions the following year. And so, you know, my analogy from the Bannister era is, yeah, maybe this can act in the same way that, I don't know how quickly it gets us to sub 2, but I sure think it changes how fast people go out in marathons and what sort of goals they're setting for themselves. And so in one way or another, it will be part of the path and to sub 2. And I guess the caveat, the thing I hear from running purists is, yeah, but when someone actually breaks sub 2, he's not going to get as much attention as Kipchoge did. And in the history books, it's all going to be Eliud Kipchoge, even though it's actually Joe Schmo who did it in the year 2026. And maybe that's true, or maybe the other analogy that crops up a lot, partially, you know, and I'm as guilty of it as anyone, is climbing Everest. You know, Hillary and Norgay climbed it with extra oxygen. Everyone remembers them. Fewer people remember that Messner and Habler were the first people to do it 20 some years later without oxygen, but they still, you know, the cognoscenti know that Messner and Habler did something amazing, and they're both barriers and they're both remembered, and we don't necessarily have to choose one or the other.
Yeah. You said that Bannister ran the 4:02, gave him the confidence to go out there and break sub 4. Do you think Kipchoge will then have the confidence to go out there and break it at another event, or do you think Joe Schmo is going to be the one coming behind him then to do it?
So, it, you know, if I had to put money down, it would be on Joe Schmo, because Kipchoge is in his mid-30s, and there's lots of rumors, and, you know, I sort of hate to peddle in rumors, but there's rumors, relatively well-founded rumors by people who have visited Kipchoge's village and talked to his parents and stuff, that, like, he's a few years older than he's generally reported. I don't know if that's true, but, you know, he was born at a time when birth registration was not compulsory or widespread.
I do the same thing, Alex. I'm much older than I tell people.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because, of course, not to get sidetracked here, but Kipchoge won the world championships in 2003 at 5,000 meters when he was 18 years old. And at that point, everyone said, oh, sure, he's 18 years old. He's probably, way older than he is. But now it's like, that's 16 years ago and he's still running at the top. So he's not immortal. And so whatever age he was, or is, he's not going to stay on top forever. And being a sort of fundamentally pessimistic, or, well, I don't know if I'm fundamentally pessimistic, but I tend to bet, when given a choice, I always bet that people will fail in a marathon because marathons are really hard. And Kipchoge, it's like that, the gambler's fallacy when you're playing roulette and it's like, I'm betting red, black. Okay, I'm going to bet red again, black. I'm going to bet red again, black. Well, it has to be red sometimes, so I'm just going to keep doubling. And in theory, you think you're going to get rich, but in fact, you go broke before you end up getting black. So with Kipchoge, I keep betting he's going to fail, and he keeps producing amazing performances. It has to stop at some point, and he's run like 13 amazing marathons in a row or something like that. So I just feel like to bridge the gap is a lot to ask to get to sub 2 under normal conditions. But he's proven me wrong, you know, the last 10 times that I've had to make predictions about him. So I wouldn't be surprised if he does, but the odds seem to be against it.
Hey, we've got, I'm on your email list. I didn't know if you knew that, but I'm on your email list. And you send out periodically articles that you find fascinating, articles that you like. Before we get into that, I want to ask one more question about our previous topic. And that is, it seemed you stated there should be some regulation for shoes. They should have some requirements, and we should stay within those confines to keep things even. And I want to kind of compare that to, we've never brought baseball up, I don't think, on this podcast. We had Eric Burns on, so we have brought up baseball, where you can only use a wooden bat in baseball and not aluminum, and you can really
in Major League Baseball.
Thank you.
You go outside America, they're using aluminum bats.
And yeah, there's a big difference. There's an advantage to swinging aluminum versus swinging a piece of wood. Do you think we should keep things confined so we can compare generation to next, or should we just let it run wild?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a tricky one. I think it's a fool's errand to try and imagine that we're going to keep things so that, you know, we can't compare Usain Bolt to Jesse Owens. It's a different world. And when we look back at the progress of world records over the last century, I think people underappreciate the extent to which changes in technology are already baked into those, to that progression. Sure, people have gotten better at training and stuff, but all weather tracks and better equipment and, you know, lots of things have changed performance in every sport. And so I'm not necessarily in favor of saying we have to keep things exactly the same as they were back in the day. But when we're allowing or considering new technologies, one thing to consider is the rate of change and the ability of everyone to access these technologies equally. And that's where the problem is coming in with the Nike shoes. For one thing, it was a dramatic sudden change. And then it didn't just stabilize at the new normal. It's like the next year they brought out a better shoe. And now Kipchoge has been modeling a new prototype, which is reportedly even better. Hmm. And so there's no new normal. And even though you can buy these Nike shoes, the reality is that most pro runners make their living from shoe sponsors. And if you're sponsored by another company, you don't really have the option of switching to this shoe that is, you know, noticeably better, unless you give up your main livelihood. So it's creating a situation with, and, you know, you could say, well, cry me a river. If you want to run in the best shoes, run in the best shoes. If you don't, and don't cry about it. And you know, there's something to that too, but, it's not so much, to answer your question, I don't think we have to freeze time and sort of preserve the rules or the equipment in amber and, you know, all be using, you know, bamboo poles to get to in the pole vaults or whatever. But I think we need to be cautious about the rate of change of technology and making sure that there's not, or trying to minimize the situations in which a few select people have equipment that's way better than everyone else, which is what happened in the 2016 Olympic marathons when a few runners, including all the medalists in the men's marathon and the gold medalist in the women's marathon, were given secret prototypes of the Nike Vaporfly. Nobody else even knew these shoes existed, but they went out there and they wiped the floor with their competitors. So, and the runners who did that are great runners, but what's unfortunate is then we can say, yeah, well, they were great, but were they really better than everyone else on that day? Or did they just have shoes that were 4% better? So there, hopefully that's sufficiently waffling that no one will be able to nail me for a strong opinion.
I think we can lift a clip out of that and send it to Good Morning America. I think we could start something here.
You know, that just reminded me, it was in the recent Olympics where Speedo had those super fast body suits.
Yeah.
And they actually pulled those away. You can't use those anymore. Is that, if I remember right?
Yeah, so there's two examples from other sports that I sort of compare the current situation to. One is speed skating. So in the late 90s, there was the introduction of something called the clap skate, mm-hmm. which is a sort of hinged blade on the skate that makes you go a lot faster. And I think it was the Dutch who initially had it. And they went out in like the 98 Olympics or something like that and just wiped the floor with everybody else. And everyone thought that was not very nice. A year later, everyone else had clap skates and life just went back to normal. It's like, everyone got the clap skates and now it's the times are faster than they were pre-clap skate, but there's no issue of like he has them, she has them, and we don't. It's just like that's the new normal. With swimming, the same thing was happening. They were just wiping out the world. They were completely rewriting the world record books every year. And the problem was it wasn't just a one-time thing. They did it in, you know, 2007 or something, and then they did it again in 2008. And then there was the next generation of suits in 2009. There was this sense of like, every year we're just wiping out the world records, and it's not because people are getting stronger or, you know, growing fins. It's because it's this technological arms race between swimsuit manufacturers. And so in 2010, they banned them, or at least they banned certain elements of it and restricted what you could do with swimsuits. And so to me, what it's going back to the sort of the new prototype that Kipchoge wore in Vienna, it's starting to feel more like the swimsuits than the clap skates. Mm-hmm. Instead of a one-time. paradigm change that made everyone faster. It's like, oh, now we're entering into this arms race phase. All the other shoe companies are trying to catch up with Nike. Nike is trying to stay ahead as a result by introducing more and more shoes. So that's why I'm saying it's not necessarily ban the shoes or ban carbon fiber plates. Let's just set some parameters so we can say this is how far we go and no far, so that we don't spend the next 5 years every year being like, well, who's got the good shoes this year?
So, Alex, why do we care? Why shouldn't we encourage this arms race so we can become better and the sports are more exciting and people travel faster? Why is this reservation to advanced technology?
Yeah, I mean, from one point of view, it's like, as you guys were saying, it's like people on the street who don't run are like, hey, what about this sub-2-hour marathon? Isn't, you know, yeah. Running is in the headlines, and that's wonderful, and it's great. And, you know, another sort of underappreciated aspect is that these shoes have this new foam that is ultra, ultra light. And because it's ultra, ultra light, you can have a thick layer, you know, similar to what Hoka has been doing for a number of years now, but you can do it even lighter and still have this great cushioning. So everyone who runs a marathon in them is like, yeah, maybe I ran 1% faster, maybe I didn't, I don't know. But what I know is that my legs feel way less beat up at the end of the marathon. And so moving away from the Kipchoges of the world and down towards the Alex Hutchinsons of the world, it's like, that sounds pretty attractive. Why would I want to ban something that's going to allow me to do something I love and not feeling, you know, maybe I'm still going to finish a marathon feeling like, you know, 10 people have been beating on my legs with a hammer, but it's different. It's better than 100 people beating on my legs with a hammer. So collect my thoughts here. So my point was, yeah, so there is a good argument for, come on, why would we not want to be better? The counter argument to that is, let's say you're Kara Goucher, who's been pretty vocal about this. You came fourth at the 2016 Olympic trials, you know, maybe a minute behind a friend of yours who came third. You subsequently, a year later, discover that she was wearing these that she and one other person in front of you was wearing these shoes that may well make you 2 minutes faster over the course of a marathon. And you're like, not only did I lose because I didn't have the fancy shoes, I didn't even know, you know, and it's hard not to think, to hear stories like that. And of course they're not uncommon, and think, well, that's not fair. Like, that's not what I think I'm tuning into when I tune into the Olympic trials or the Olympic marathon. To me, you know, you can think of, again, you know, another analogy is Formula One versus NASCAR. Do you want to have Formula One? Nobody's mad if they introduce, you know, a better engine or carburetor or whatever. I'm not a car guy, so I don't really know. But Formula One is a contest of engineers, and of course the drivers matter, but the engineers are an integral part of the competition. Stock car, NASCAR, the theory is the cars are all the same, and it's the best driver who wins. And we think of running as a stock car kind of competition. Technology has little role in running. And so now we're saying, hey, the runners still matter, but if you don't have the right shoes, you're going to be 3% behind. That's a change, and it's not one that sits easily, I think, for a lot of people, including me. Although that doesn't mean I'm necessarily like, we need to ban everything, but it's not crazy to think, hey, let's try it and make sure that it's, as Des Linden, the marathoner, said before New York, let's make sure it's a foot race, not an arms race.
Hmm. Yeah, great point, and thanks for sharing that perspective. I wasn't able to puzzle that out, and it was good to hear what your thoughts were on it. Let's talk about some of these articles that are on your email list, and how do people first, before we get to any article, how do you get on this list that I'm referring to?
You have to have a very special secret code.
Yes.
No. if you find, I should probably make this easier, but if you find any one of my articles, the secret key is at the bottom of each article where I beg you on bended knee to sign up for my email list. So if you, the path I will suggest is if you find me on Twitter, which is at Sweat Science, Sweat Science is my username. I'm relentlessly pimping out my articles. And so if you click on one of those articles, you'll find at the bottom a sign up link for the mailing list.
Well, I can attest that it is very easy because I didn't even know I did it. and on
maybe the Russians did it, Don.
That could be. Hey, Scott, what's one of your favorite articles?
The one that captured my eye or my attention was, did scientists really find a speed-boosting microbe?
Oh man,
do you remember that one?
yeah that was
speaking of it, of arms races, let's talk about this microbe,
the poop race. That's the key thing. Yeah, I mean, this is part of a sort of long running area of hype and fascination about the microbiome. So we've been hearing for whatever, 5-10 years now that, you know, actually you're nothing. It's the microbes inside you, the billions and billions of organisms inside you that are, you know, determine who you are and how you respond to food and so on. And so there's been a lot of interest in whether athletes have different, organisms living within them. And so there's a study from a Harvard group, this is a few months ago, where they looked at marathoners, Boston marathoners, and compared them to non-runners and tried to figure out, are there specific organisms that maybe distinguish runners from non-runners? And they found a set of organisms. I can't, you know, and I'm not going to lie, I can't remember the name of this particular organism, but basically there's an organism that lives in the gut of marathoners, which basically acts as it soaks up lactate and turns it into a form of energy that can be used or reused by the body. So the story here is really compelling. If you're a runner, you develop this microbe in your gut that when you exercise hard and start producing lactate, this organism, first of all, helps reduce levels of lactate by soaking up lactate and then turns it into an easily accessible form of energy that helps you, in theory, run faster. And so this story got a lot of attention because it's such a great story. And I looked at the study and, you know, it's good and it's interesting. And they were very careful. They did things like, you know, they took mice and injected this microbe into them and showed that it made the mice run faster and things like that. So it's a promising area of inquiry. The key point that I'll add is that the researchers who did this formed a company several years ago with the goal of producing some probiotic for runners. And so they've just been looking and looking and looking to find some bug that is different in runners than in non-runners, and then to put it in a pill and sell it to runners. And the problem with that approach, it doesn't mean that the results aren't true or aren't good. The problem is, if you really, really want to find something that will seem to enhance performance, you'll almost certainly find it. And that is because you'll run test after test after test until you get a result that says, wow, we saw a statistically significant effect, which may be true, or it may just be that you kept looking until the dice rolled the way you wanted them to roll. So the profit motive complicates the picture. So to me, this is let's keep watching. And I actually went to a talk on the athletes and the microbiome just last week at a conference. This is a topic that people are interested in and research continues in. But my strong advice would be, do not buy any pills, especially if they came from the poop of other runners. Like, that's a general life advice, until there's a lot more evidence. Even then, like, I would say maybe just stop there. Just don't do it. But
even if there's evidence, then you can consider. No, you don't.
Oh, I mean, you show up to the outhouse at a marathon and you can harvest. You have, that's your plant.
Well, you know, like 5 years ago when this stuff started to be discussed, I got an email from a friend of mine saying, basically, I'm just counting the days until people start marketing pills made from, you know, Rift Valley poop harvested from, you know, elite Kenyan marathoners. It's got to be the next thing. And then, you know, like 2 years later, this or whatever, this study came out and I emailed them back and I was like, you were right. It's coming. It's not a joke. It's not the onion. So, you know, like, this is one of those tricky things where the microbiome research is really interesting and really, it's real stuff. It's good science. It's just complicated science. And as soon as you start trying to take the complicated science and say, how can we monetize this and put it in a pill and sell it to people? There's a risk that you start sort of, glossing over some of the uncertainties and just looking for the most promising data. So I'm not trying to impugn the reputation of these researchers, but I'm not buying any poop pills either.
Hey, so let me ask this question. Do you think it's a microorganism that flourishes as a adaptive process in people that do long endurance, or is it something we ingest and it just happens to be fortunate that you are eating the right stuff?
Yeah, or you know, that's a great. That's actually the question that's at the crux of it. And you know, the other option is if you run a lot, maybe you're spending time, you're producing lactate a lot, and so you're providing the food for this particular type of organism so that it flourishes, and you get a higher and higher proportion of this. You tend to favor the organisms that are good for this running process. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is one of the, when you start digging into this study, this is the key. You look and it's like, well, tell me again what the difference is between the non-runners and the runners. And you're like, oh, there actually wasn't a statistically significant difference in the amount in the non-runners and runners. So now, you know, it's not at all clear the way they did it. It's not at all clear whether this is something you acquire or whether this is something you're born with. And as a result, maybe not born with, but something you by fluke, as a 2-year-old, you end up with these bugs in your gut. And as a result, you grow up and discover you're good at running because your intestine is really good at helping you. I think that latter scenario is unlikely. I think it's more likely that as you run, you probably nurture. Mm-hmm. If the story is true, it's as you run, you nurture these particular bacteria. And so then the question is like, well, so what happens if you try and increase the amount? Like, you're already nurturing it. So maybe the goal is you take this pill if you're a non-runner and it makes you seem like a runner, but it's like, man, there's a lot more that you get out of running than really good bacteria in your gut. You're missing 99.999% of the things that are important. So then you get back to this sort of circular, like, then why am I taking the pill, or who cares? What, you know, what's the point?
Yeah, and then you have to be careful with who's writing the study. Just like you're saying, the poop pill makers want you to think that it's in the poop pill. And so you get a one-sided read on that study. So it's good to be an objective reviewer of studies.
Yeah. So again, it's interesting research, and I think the questions you're asking are the ones that I would like to see answered. And as you know, just developing on your point there, the questions that you're most interested in answering are different if you're like, I want to understand how the body works versus I want to sell something. So the questions they're trying to answer are not necessarily the ones that I think are most interesting, which are the ones you're talking about. Like, do you just naturally get this, or where does it come from?
Okay. The one that came out to me. Good. Thank you, Alex. Great point.
Speaking of the theme of this show is what can you do or add to your diet or put in your shoe or anything to make you faster rather than just doing the work? Along with that, we have another article.
How Jell-O could speed up injury recovery.
Yeah, we're looking for shortcuts or things that taste good.
Exactly.
Right.
Although maybe that segue wasn't quite right from the poop pill, but
this is the beginning process.
So this is interesting stuff, actually, and this is again an area that I think is really promising research, although preliminary. And the one thing I'll say about this, so this is some research, and I'll explain what it is in a sec, but this is some research by a guy named Keith Barr in one of the University of California campuses. And the thing with Jell-O is you can't patent it. So it's very hard to get rich. So you know, because I keep asking, I've met him at conferences a few times, and I ask him about how the research is going, and because it's started to get a lot of hype, people are like, yeah, Jell-O is the new miracle thing. And he's saying, yeah, it's getting overhyped, and he's concerned about that, but it's not like he's getting rich off it, because it's either just Jell-O, or if not Jell-O, it's gelatin. You know, the key, you know, Jell-O is gelatin and a crap ton of sugar. So maybe you don't want to take Jell-O, but gelatin itself is, again, something you can't patent that. So he's not monetizing it. So he's more interested in the research angle. Now, scientists, conflict of interests are not just about money. Scientists get attached to their hypotheses, like we were talking about earlier, and so that doesn't mean he or anyone else is totally impartial. But at least he's not like trying to peddle Jell-O out of the back of his truck or anything. So anyway, to answer what the actual question is, there's a key insight, which is that tendons and ligaments, which are things that are of great interest to runners, are not the same as your cardiovascular system or even your muscles. For both your muscles and your cardiovascular system, if you want to get them stronger, you need to work hard and do it a lot. And, you know, the more you train, the better, but, you know, within certain obvious constraints. the conventional wisdom on tendons and ligaments is actually they're impossible to train. They don't change. You reach adulthood and your Achilles tendon is basically, it is what it is. And it's not, nothing's going to change it. And there's even some studies people have done with like the levels of radioactive carbon that are still linger in the environment from above ground nuclear testing in the 1950s. You can use that to calculate, well, how much did this, did a given piece of tissue change after you know age 18? And what they when they've done studies with a bunch of cadavers from different ages, they take a tendon and measure the carbon levels, and they're like, yeah, once these people hit 18, their tendons stopped changing. Basically, their tendon was what they was, that was it. And so there's this sense that once you get a bad tendon, it's, you can't heal it, you can't strengthen it. There's nothing, almost nothing you can do to tendons. And so this guy Keith Barr, he's developed. So this is a long version of the story, but I'll go with the assumption that it's interesting. I think he's at UC Davis. So they're near, what is it, Squaw Valley, one of the big ski hills. And so the local hospital has all these ruptured ACL tendons or ligaments that they're just, you know, throwing in a bucket from all these skiers. So he harvests these bits of ACL and learned to grow basically engineered ligaments that he can test in the lab and try and figure out, how does a ligament actually respond to training? How does this ligament that we've grown in a petri dish, if we exercise it, or if we give it different kinds of nutrients, what happens? And so the first really interesting insight is that ligaments, tendons, and bones, they basically stop responding to exercise after maybe 10 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes. You do a workout, you do some hops, you do some whatever, step-ups or whatever, your tendon is reacting. But you do it for half an hour, and in fact, your tendon is actually becomes less responsive. After 10 minutes, it's like, that's enough, dude, stop. And whatever adaptive signal you're trying to send stops. So that's it takes about 6 hours before the tendon is sort of willing to listen to the signal to adapt again. So he's been advising a bunch of, you know, NBA players, professional football players and basketball players and so on. And if they're trying to recover from a key, you know, a tendon or a ligament injury, and you know, this is their job, they're doing like 5 minutes every 6 hours, three times a day, of just not like killing themselves, but doing some sort of, you know, isometric hold or something, step ups or whatever, 5 minutes, and then nothing else for 6 hours. And that's totally separate from their muscle or their cardiovascular training. They're doing this just for the tendons. Now, the next thing is, which is getting back to the Jell-O, you know, at long last, what are these tendons and ligaments and in fact bones made out of? They're made out of collagen. Is there a way you can supply more collagen that will, help stimulate this regrowth process in this tissue that normally we think just doesn't change? And, well, you could say, well, maybe you need to give it some collagen. It's hard to do that. It's hard to get collagen in the form that it's needed. You know, you swallow it, it just gets broken up. And so there's been lots of controversy about this idea that if you take hydrolyzed collagen, like it's a popular beauty supplement and stuff like that. But he has shown, starting with gelatin, which is a form of collagen, that you take, I can't remember, some amount, an amount that adds up to like 6 boxes of conventional Jell-O. So you don't want to just do it the Jell-O way. Otherwise you're going to get diabetes in like 10 minutes. but with just plain food grade gelatin, you do that, whatever, 10 minutes or half an hour before you do this 5 minutes of exercise, and that will, you know, double the rate of response, at least in his engineered ligaments. So there's some really compelling and interesting lab data, and people have started to adopt it at the pro level when they're like, man, we're willing to try anything. And there's been a little bit of human data, but there's still a long way to go before we know it works. But it's a really, so to me, the gelatin is interesting. But what's even more interesting is sort of understanding that, yeah, when you're trying to train a ligament, strengthen a ligament or a tendon, it's just different than muscle. It's not more is better. It's not, you know, hit it as hard. It's trigger it a little bit, give it a break, trigger it a little bit again, give it a break, and so on.
Since tendons are the ends of muscles and where they attach to the bone, so muscle comes down, becomes a tendon, and then holds onto the bone, how do you train a tendon versus a muscle? What's the difference?
So fundamentally, I'm going to have to refer that question to Keith Barr, because I'm not, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but so I'll give you an example. I asked him like, okay, what do you talk to me about Achilles tendinosis or tendinopathy or whatever you want to call it. What would you suggest for a runner with a chronic Achilles problem? So what is the actual exercise you do in this case? And his suggestion was, listen, you do heel raises, but you don't do like 12 of them with a heavy weight or anything. You do one of them and sustain it for 30 seconds, or you do a couple of them, sustain it for 30 seconds. And the reason you do that, so you're not, and for a muscle, that's not doing a whole lot. That's not giving the stimulus that a muscle responds to. But for the tendon, really what you kind of want to do is tug on it lengthwise. And the problem is if you have a problem in your tendon, let's say you have a damaged area, the tendon is these long parallel strands of collagen. And so the force just kind of runs around the damaged area. So you're tugging on it, but you're actually not putting any tension on the damaged area because the healthy area is taking all the tension. But if you just get up on your toe and for a one-legged heel raise and hold it for 30 seconds, what happens over that 30 seconds is the tension gradually relaxes. And so the tension shifts from the healthy area to eventually it starts putting tension on the damaged area because you're giving it time under tension to relax. In the same way that if you pull an elastic band and just hold it there, it'll eventually go slack. Even if you're not pulling anymore, it loses some of the elasticity. So that's the kind of training approach, quote unquote, or activity that targets the properties of the tendon rather than just trying to exhaust the muscle.
Hey, I think that was really a perfect answer, and so I think you handled that well. More than repetition.
I wonder if the people in Utah, which is the state that consumes the most Jell-O of any state, I wonder if their tendons and ligaments are healthier.
So when it comes to that was one of the questions I had, and maybe you stated it, and I drifted off trying to think of what you said just before. Is it you ingest the gelatin, or are they injecting it locally, or how are they administering this Jell-O?
It's oral. You're eating it, and this is controversial. I've talked to other tendon experts who are like, that you're full of crap. Like, that doesn't do anything. It gets broken down into amino acids, and it never reaches the key part of the body. I definitely want to convey that there's debate about this and controversy, but yeah, the idea here is you eat it, and in fact, so what. My understanding is that you're not eating a little piece of tendon that flies down to your tendon and gets glued onto the tendon. In fact, it does get broken down into its constituent amino acids, but there's a couple of key amino acids, and the main one I think is proline. That's very in elevated levels. Collagen has and gelatin have a high level of proline, and so it's a rate limiting step for the resynthesis of collagen in a tendon or ligament. So by taking gelatin, what you're doing is you're getting higher levels of proline, which are going to go everywhere in your body, including to the tendon, which is then going to be able to remodel at a slightly higher rate.
Do you think chocolate Jell-O pudding would qualify for this? Just checking in on some of my weaknesses.
There's only one way to find out, and that's with copious experimentation.
Will do. Experiment of one. Scott, what jumps out at you on that list?
You know, the one thing that
Thank
I was...
Thank you, Alex.
You know, we don't have a whole lot of time left on the podcast, but the one thing... So we've talked about things that you can ingest to give you an advantage. We've talked about shoes or things you put on. Now let's get into the complete opposite. Let's get into the mind again. And that's one of the greatest parts of your book, Endure. You had an article where you talked about a new study that looks at the effect of subtle wording and how that can change and boost your performance.
Refresh my memory on what it was about.
It says, how to talk yourself into better endurance. A new study looks at the effect of subtle wording changes on the performance-boosting power of motivational stealth talk.
Yes. So this has been a long area of interest for me, trying to figure out. So, you know, I ended up being convinced that
While you're gathering your thoughts, we talked to one of our good friends, Chad Wright, and he did he doesn't curse. He's a Marine, Navy SEAL, and that's a pretty area where there's a lot of cursing. And he through his endurance career, he just doesn't curse. And he went up and trained Jesse Itzler and NFL football star on and did this run. And he said one of the rules of this run that we're going to be doing is there is no cursing. And he says for him, just the negative connotation of a curse word destroys him mentally.
That's his kryptonite.
His kryptonite.
Yeah.
That's interesting because there is a small body of research showing that cursing can enhance your pain tolerance. That they do these studies like, you know, dip your hand in ice water while yelling various different things, and you can sustain it for longer because when you're cursing. And the idea is, you know, maybe it for some people it depends, and it obviously depends on the associations, but may kind of be one way of triggering a fight or flight response.
And
of course that may be different if you're sitting in a lab when you're not already in that zone, whereas if you're out on a run, yelling that maybe isn't going to do anything more than, you know, the situation is already going to be. But anyway, I now remember what study you're talking about. And yeah, so this was just to give the backstory, which is that in terms of understanding, you know, it's one thing to say, yeah, the mind plays a role in the limits of endurance, but then the obvious question is, well, how do we change it? And the one area where I found that there was actually some pretty decent research trying to quantify and investigate this was this idea of motivational self-talk, which is just changing the words in your head. You know, instead of saying this sucks and I want to quit, saying, you know, I've trained really hard and I know I can do this. And it's easy to say that, and I've said it many times, but the next follow-up question is, okay, well, how do I do this? And what exactly am I supposed to say? And in general, my answer to that has been, I don't know. I mean, like, figure it out, try some things, see what works for you, because it's very personal. But from a scientific perspective, the thing that I would like to see is, okay, let's start trying to investigate different options and try and understand what the variables are you can change. So this study you were mentioning is one of the sort of first attempts at doing this from a group in Wales at the University of Bangor. And they looked at the difference between basically first person and second person. Is there a difference between saying, I can do this, and saying, you can do this? Mm-hmm. And they found that there really was a difference, that there's something to do with, it's hard to know what the explanation is, but they were explaining in terms of self-distancing. When you're sort of looking on at yourself, you're able to step out of your own kind of crisis moment, and instead of thinking about all the things that you're thinking about, you're like, here's this person, you can do this. This other person, they're capable of doing this. And so they found this was a small but subtle effect. And I don't think it's like the be-all and end-all, but it's an indication that what you say to yourself can make a difference. And I think it's a good kind of starting point to start trying teasing out what are the things we should be trying to say to ourselves.
And I think that lends to probably the rationale for many of us, and I know this goes against what you're saying, that when you say, I can do it, that's a little bit stronger than someone looking at you that says, you can do it. I believe that's what you said. But it doesn't discount that you can do it. It does have some relevance and some help.
So just to correct, it was actually the you can do it that did better.
Oh, good.
It was helping you step out of yourself so not being bogged down in your own head as much.
Yeah, so I'm glad you said that because it makes this story better. it's the reason we look at each other and go through aid stations. You're looking good. You can do this. You've got this. We are constantly in our community bombarding one another with encouragement to pursue, to continue, not to give up. And even fellow runners passing each other. Yeah, you got this, you know, you're passing me now, you'll pass me on the down, you know, just encouraging. Everything's always positive. And I think the so many things that we do just as cultures and communities have evolved over time, and we've learned them. We've passed them on because we find they work, and we may not recognize that they work. We just do it because it's collectively has worked out well when we do. So
yeah, I think that's a great point. I think it is interesting how often we end up circling back to like, oh, now the science is finally complete, and we realize that what we were doing in the first place was right. Now we have maybe a richer understanding of why, and maybe we have a little more sort of subtle, nuanced understanding of when strategy A might be better than strategy B. But it's rare that it's like, oh, we've been running on our legs all this time. We should have been running on our arms if only we'd done the studies. Like, we don't really get those sort of generally, we stumble on pretty good answers most of the time. I mean, another classic example is all the debates about things like running cadence and stuff like that. It's like so many studies on running cadence because people are like, oh, we got to figure out what the optimal cadence is. And there's still debate about this, but I would say that the general consensus is humans are pretty good at intuiting a good cadence. I mean, and there are exceptions, and you know, footwear can play a role, but it's like rarely is there the... do we get that eureka moment where it's like, yeah, we've been doing it all wrong?
Yeah, it's time to give our ancestors a little more credit and not just the scientists, because I think our ancestors have had a lot of time to figure things out.
But I also think, and I'm thinking of a discussion I had with a colleague just yesterday. I work in agriculture, plant science and nutrition and biology. And it wasn't until we know that the element, the nutrient boron, is necessary for plant growth. That we've known that for years, decades and decades, but only until the last few decades, within the last decade, we understood why. And because we now know the reason why, we can refine it and make it better. And I think that kind of plays a role here, where, you know, maybe we do know that we run on our feet. And we run faster. We move faster when we're running on our feet. But maybe we didn't understand why. I think that's a stretch of my analogy, but you get where I'm going.
Yeah, exactly. Even when we, like, and sometimes there's this criticism of like, why did we need science to tell us this? You know, I already knew that. Well, it's like, no, you thought you knew it. Now we really know it. And there's a difference because, like you said, now we can refine that knowledge and maybe we can come up with some, you know, shaving some time off around the edges, but we're not radically reshaping our understanding of things.
Alex, thank you for making that sound intelligent. Whatever
you gotta
I said,
have boron. Gotta have boron.
Whatever I said, you just made it sound intelligent, and I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Well, he rescued me earlier, and now rescue yourself and go to one of Alex's articles. Scroll down to the bottom, click on it. Don't make this man get on a bended knee to beg for a subscription. These articles are great. They pertain to us as athletes, and they tackle the things that you really want to think about, and may not even be aware that you want to think about it until you see the article. He's gone out and researched, looked, read a lot of things, probably disqualified. Last question. How many articles do you read before one qualifies to get on your podium finish?
Yeah, you know, I scan through a lot of, I don't necessarily read the whole articles, but abstracts, it's, you know, hundreds. Yeah. for any given article. Now, I will say, I will give some credit to a much maligned medium, which is social media. Twitter has kind of helped in terms of doing a bit of a filtering for me, because there's some really good scientists who share their opinions on Twitter. And in some cases, they'll just tweet out when they see an interesting study. So in addition to doing this sort of like, you know, half a dozen journals, I'm going to scroll through their table of contents every week, I also go to a few, you know, half a dozen Twitter accounts and say, what have these guys got to say right now? And it's, oh, there's an interesting article in a journal that I would not have normally come across. So that's a huge advantage.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for keeping us up to date so that we can apply some of this science and apply it to our own athletic endeavors.
And, and if you want to see the cliff notes of all of the Twitter accounts that Alex follows, follow his Twitter account at Sweat Science.
All right. Alex, thank you so much for spending some time with us again. And we hope that you'll take our call next time when we're looking out.
Thanks, guys. I had a great time.
Now go out and run.
Moss.